do you know what, Will?
What?
I said a bit of this to this episode at all, like, exposition.
Fuck it.
What the fuck are we doing with ourselves doing a podcast about exposition?
I just can't wait to see how we'll blow up in the podcast charts because of this topic. It's just such a hot topic.
I wanted to do it because I have an awful lot to say, but no, I can't remember what I wanted to say, so let's just get into it.
Might as well.
The best bits. I'll use small words that you'll be sure to understand, you warthog-faced buffoon.
What you just said is one of the most insanely idiotic things I have ever heard. Everyone in this room is now dumber for having listened to it.
You are stupid, you have no taste, a lousy sense of humor, and you smell.
Don't call me stupid.
Hello and welcome to The Best Bits, a movie podcast. We pick our favourite scenes from randomly selected, weirdly specific themes. This is your co-host, Kevin, a writer of 100-bit films and 300-bit episodes of TV. And I'm joined once again by a man with a master's in screenwriting who's also a member of the Academy of Motion Pictures Arts and Sciences, a man who's been recognised for distinction within his craft by the Annies, the Emmys, the Oscars and the IFTAs, a winner of a Writers Guild of Ireland Award and the BAFTA, husband to Karen, father to Luke, Ellie, Chloe, plus a cat named Fred, but who's known to many as just a plain old writer of three films, A Christmas Special and The Star War, Will Anthony Collins.
I really was wondering. I say, are you going to do this straight? Are you going to do this straight? You're not going to put some spin on it. And there you are, a lot of exposition.
That was just off the top of my head.
I'm impressed.
Yeah.
Did ChatGPT give you that?
Do you know what? Dave Minogue, who's been on our podcast before, he said to me, are your show notes written by ChatGPT? And I said, how fucking dare you? I write those things. So now I think everybody's getting their head twisted because we're all thinking that everything is suspiciously ChatGPT.
Everything is ChatGPT.
I saw a picture of myself the other day and I thought, is that computer generated? No, I'm just that gorgeous.
So fucking handsome. It's so dreamy. Nobody on the planet could be that enticing. Ooh, I think I've fallen in love with someone and he's
I'm
me.
Telling you. But yeah, exposition. I'm in that headspace at the moment because I'm writing a script. And I have a few things I want to say about exposition dumps, as they're called.
Sure.
And
sure, dude.
They've gotten a bad rap. I think that, you know, we're all conditioned as writers to be cognizant of exposition because it's considered to be artificial writing or false. You know, it's just there to deliver plot. It's got nothing to do with character. Yeah. But I think that you can make some really great characterful scenes from exposition and that it's become a little bit like CG where you only really notice it when it's bad.
That's exactly it, Kevin.
That was a hard pivot there, wasn't it? We went from just giddy bouncing about the place to straight in there with the thesis of the episode.
No, you went straight into her. Well, you want to know something? I was joking on our Discord before we got on chatting.
What's
earlier
that?
On, and I said, oh, I'm just rushing. I said, I'm rushing here and I would like,
what's
you know,
what's
trying
that? Tell
to
the people, drop the exposition for the people.
Oh, sorry. Oh, the Discord is our patron exclusive platform, not exclusive,
well,
it's the platform that we use to chat with our patrons, and it is hopping.
It
forget
is.
Your Twitters, forget your Threads, forget your Blue Skies and all that sort of stuff.
We've got Kevin's Corner, Will's Games Room, Dick Pick Central, it's all in there.
And it's all from Richard. That's Richard's pictures.
Yeah. He's all over it. He's just
Dick's pics
constantly.
Dick's pics. And he's really good. Like, I love his cute animal photography. He's amazing.
It's just like, what kind of an animal is that? This is a cock. Oh, no.
But I love it. It's his animals. His small animal dick pics.
Yeah.
They're brilliant. They're my favourite.
And they come with little facts. Did you know that polar bears have never met a penguin? What's this got to do with a dick?
So this is our
audience.
Come on over. Become a patron. Join the Discord. Join the crack. And why don't you join Dick's Picks? Sorry.
Oh,
so this is basically what the sort of thing that happens in our Patreon or Discord.
We can say whatever we want, Will. No one's going to hear this episode.
I know.
So.
Oh, yeah. But what I was saying was on the Discord, I joked that the research I'm doing for this episode feels like me coming into school doing my homework on the rickety bus while everyone's shouting at me. And I've got nothing done. I've nothing prepared.
48 minutes of research.
But it's not true. Because in actual fact, being screenwriters for being a professional screenwriter now for over 15 years at this age, I don't know how long exactly I've been a professional screenwriter.
You started late.
I started late, yeah. Definitely. And I should have finished early.
You can get going in your career in your 40s.
Yeah. But we've been dealing with exposition and exposition scenes for the longest time. And truly, for me, dealing with exposition is one of the most challenging aspects of being a screenwriter. You can do it poorly, and everyone can see you do it poorly, or you can do it really well and elegantly, and no one ever sees it. And that's the fucking challenge.
Do you know what I have noticed about exposition? Because I had to deal with it on writing the film, Grabbers.
Right.
Show, don't tell definitely works when it comes to exposition. If you see something, you will remember it. It'll be a lot more impactful than if you're told it. Mm-hmm. Relatively, it's got to be really great fucking writing if somebody just says something and that sticks with you and you sort of, oh, I get it. Exposition scenes are all over every film. They're not like, you know, just in bad films. It's wherever a character is new to a world. And maybe the audience needs to be brought up to speed on what's going on in this world. Like if it's a sports film, you need somebody to tell you what the rules are of the sport.
When you're getting your pitch, you're hitting 625, which is massive. You're crushing the ball. But when you're swinging things, you know, that your pitch is middle in. And when you're swinging low and away and stuff, you're batting 158. Every at-bat's like a hand of blackjack. Every card that's dealt, your odds completely change. So every first pitch strike, your batting average goes down about 75 points.
75 points?
He should be throwing 100 pitches before the fifth inning.
I'm going to knock that starter out and eat deep into their bullpen. I want you to take in at-bats off the 10th and 11th pitcher by the end of the series.
Or if it's like a spy movie where somebody's been given a mission, what is the reason for that mission? What is the objective? That's exposition.
Yeah.
Your mission, should you choose to accept it, is to penetrate the highly secured archive inside the Kremlin and retrieve Cobalt's file before he can destroy it.
Yeah.
And then you've got really shit exposition, like, hi sis, and that's just purely to let the audience know they're siblings.
Hey sis.
Hey sis.
Hey sis, congratulations.
Oh, thank you so much.
Hold on, sis.
Hey monkey.
Hey sis.
Hi sis.
Hi, sis.
Hi, sis. Got your hands full, huh?
Thanks, sis.
You're welcome.
You use the expression there, show, don't tell, which is like, you know, illustrate, don't have a character saying what we need to say. But in execution, one of my things that I'm trying to employ more and more now in my writing is not show, don't tell, feel, don't tell. Make the audience feel what you want them to feel about the exposition.
How do you
do
that?
Like, well, how an example is, right? The very opening of Star Wars, A New Hope, right?
Pure exposition dump.
The opening of Star Wars, we get the crawl, right? We get that text crawl after da-da-da-da-da, right? But the music is giving us all the information, but the music, John Williams' score, is giving us that triumphant, exciting march, the Star Wars march. But then that opening action scene on the where we have the blockade runner zooming, small little narrow blockade runner zooming overhead, it's running away and it's getting fired upon by these red lasers, pew, 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 right? And then this big, huge monstrosity of a ship coming after it, swallowing it. Even that shot alone
tells you everything.
Because it's telling us about and also telling us what we should feel about the world. There's these little guys who are getting chased and hounded and harried by this big, scary fucking monstrosity. We understand. We understand the parameters of this world in that one incredible shot. That's effective exposition. You feel that rather than anyone telling you anything. Exposition only, as you said, only becomes a major issue when it feels like you are, when things are confused and you're dumping story data. Oh,
when it's really clunky. I'll tell you, you're talking about the pre-credits there to Star Wars, where it's not even Star Wars, the title comes up and then you get the crawl. But in that similar space, Crimson Tide, right? That has a long 2-3 minute like pre-credits sequence where they're telling you what's going on in the world, what the state of the Cold War is at that time, so that you can get up to speed with the dilemma that Gene Hackman and Denzel Washington are going to have to deal with while on that nuclear sun.
This is Richard Valeriani reporting live for CNN from the French aircraft carrier Foch, somewhere in the Mediterranean. 6 days ago, as the rebellion in Chechnya spread to the neighboring Caucasus republics, the Russian president ordered massive bombing strikes against rebel positions
and Belokhani.
It's basically a newsreel where you're watching the newsreader tell you what's going on and how many subs are out there and what could go wrong. But then they also mm-hmm. have what's become a real trope now of kind of clunky, cheesy exposition, but yet it kind of works in Crimson Tide. And that's where it's similar to what I did with the intro. It's somebody telling somebody else their CV, and there's no okay. need for Gene Hackman in his first scene with Denzel Washington to read his resume out to him.
Annapolis. Five patrols on fast attacks, two on boomers, one is XO. A year at, excuse me, Harvard. I talked to your former CO. He tells me he tried to adopt you. As you no doubt heard, my XO has appendicitis. He's the best I ever had. I need a good man to fill his spot. Your name was at the top of the list.
Oh, that's good to know, sir.
It was a short list.
It doesn't make any sense. Like, Gene Hackman would already know that. That would all have happened before that scene would have taken place. But it's necessary just for the audience. But Gene Hackman kind of makes it work because he uses it as a way to demean him, which is like, oh, this is your CV. Yeah. It's incredibly impressive. And you went to Harvard. Okay. It just does not mean shit to him. But you will see that an awful lot in films where someone will tell somebody else something that they already know.
Still in all ears, my brother.
Why are you telling me all this?
It's plot exposition. It has to go somewhere. Anyway.
I think what you've hit on there is something that I find is critical when you're depositing. It's like reversing a big truck, dump truck up to your audience and tipping out the load. You have to make it that load like lovely marshmallows.
You want to dump that load on the audience in a way that is consensual.
Exactly. They want it.
Yeah.
They want it. They have to enjoy it.
And they're begging for it.
They're begging for it.
No, but we're joking. But I'm going to say to you, absolutely 1,000%, when I am dealing with writing exposition, you want exposition to be a reward for paying attention. You want the audience to be desperately like, tell me something so I can get a handle on this. And when you get to that moment in the story and then you're giving exposition, it's really exciting and... Like, there's so many scenes I want to talk about on this episode.
Yeah.
But there's one really, really good one to sort of demonstrate what I'm talking about here. In The Matrix, the very first Matrix, when they basically have to tell you what the premise of the movie is. And Neo, who is taking the audience surrogate's role, usually in a film you'll have a character who's created to purely be the receiver of Basil Exposition's briefing of what's happening. They're like, what's this? What's that? Where are we going? It's their first day on the job type of character. Those characters are so helpful when you're writing stuff because they will teach that person and therefore teach the audience what they need to know. But in The Matrix, Neo is that audience surrogate character. He's the one that doesn't know anything. And so Morpheus has to explain to him, this is where we are in the world. This is what's happened.
This is the construct. It's our loading program. We can load anything from clothing to equipment, weapons, training simulations, anything we need.
And they do it in a very fascinating visual way, which is first to take him into a magical white room where anything can be conjured and they can do anything. Teaches him that he can learn Kung Fu by just an uplink.
How do you define real? If you're talking about what you can feel, what you can smell, you can taste and see, then real is simply electrical signals interpreted by your brain.
It's all exposition, but it's fucking fun. It's great scenes. And therefore, it just tells you exposition scenes can be some of the best scenes in a film.
Yeah. And to add to your point, I think exposition has to be like a killer hook. If you have got a killer hook, that's your exposition. That's not going to sustain a dramatic story or a screenplay, as in that scene alone. But if you got a hook, your audience is leaning in. In that instance with Matrix, the Matrix is the audience is going, oh my God, this is such a cool concept. Oh my God, what if we were all living in a simulation? And the way it's explained is very enticing. I was thinking about this, right? And I said, that's an example of that type of exposition, you know, delivered to the audience where it's done really, really well. And I was out kind of thinking about this earlier on. I was out going, are there any examples of that type of delivery done really poorly? And one film came to mind, which should have been a great film, but didn't work at all. And it was the Brad Bird film, Tomorrowland. Do you remember that film?
Oh, yeah. That was a very sluggish film.
It was one of those films where we had an avatar. We had a young girl was our kind of the audience's surrogate into that world. It seems like the right way into this mad concept.
But all I remember about her is that she wore a baseball cap.
Yeah. But once she started stepping into this confusing world, like Neo steps into the Matrix, it never makes sense. The hook of that exposition of what is actually going on behind us never makes sense. And the further the story went along, the more the story actually had to deliver more exposition to explain what's going on over here and what's going over there and what's going on. It's your exposition has been neat and tidy.
That's where it starts to feel like you should only have to deliver exposition once.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you get it.
Yeah.
After that, it feels like you're plugging holes in a sinking ship.
Mm-hmm.
And it starts to feel a little bit like studio executive notes, which is we need to over-explain everything.
And also maybe the core concept wasn't watertight to begin with.
I thought that you were going to say Matrix Revolutions.
Hello, Neo.
Oh, I could have. Oh, I would say the Matrix Revolutions.
Vis-a-vis.
But I can't remember.
Concordantly.
I can't remember The Matrix Revolutions. I've only ever seen it once. Tell me about The Matrix Revolutions versus the very first one. How does it work so poorly in that?
I can't remember it either. He just gets to the end of the film and it ends with a diatribe being delivered by the architect.
I am the architect coupled with the function.
It was just tedious. It just went on and on and on and on and on.
The process has altered your consciousness. You remain irrevocably human.
When exposition is a springboard into what's going to come next, it's really exciting. When it feels like a character has gone to a precipice, they've gone up to a place where now they need answers.
Yeah.
And you're going to give them answers and those answers are leading to more questions. It's tantalizing. That's when exposition is like exciting. It's like, oh, we're getting in on it. We're up to speed now with the character. What are they going to do next?
Yeah.
But when it's coming at the finale, you've just structured it all wrong.
Only time if it's structured that way and it's effective, if it's the answer to a mystery, you know, a whodunit or some sort of mystery that's, you know, kind of that's been trailed through the story, but not necessarily the driving force of the story. That you will get, like in whodunits, you do get those exposition dumps. And like, you know, all of them. You just look at our whodunit episodes and they all have exposition dumps towards the end. But it's a satisfying unraveling of like the case, which it's not driving. The mystery is what's driving the plot, you know?
Bad exposition as well can kill a film's buzz. Like, do you remember just recently with the Madame Web trailer that came out and she had that really clunky line?
He was in the Amazon with my mom when she was researching spiders right before she died.
And it wasn't in the film, but I think that was such a bad line of exposition that it just set up the audience to really hate that film. Like that is, that's taking the piss out of an audience's intelligence. So yeah, it is like CG for me. It's like, you know, when it's bad, it sticks out like a sore thumb. It's like the film calls attention to the fact that it's a film.
Yeah.
Suddenly you're like, you're aware that somebody wrote that.
Yeah.
It doesn't feel natural within the scene. But then there's ways, like you can make stuff sound better. It's just about having a soft touch.
He was researching spiders in the Amazon with my mom before she died.
The hardest aspects of any of the screenplays I've written to make work are the exposition scenes, as I've already probably said. But I can tell you a little anecdote, which I hope I haven't told before in the podcast, about Song of the Sea. In Song of the Sea, it's about a brother and sister who are normal, well, seemingly normal kids who live in a normal world. But when they get pulled into the fairy world, the rules and the characters of that world have to be explained so that they are kind of like, they know what they're facing, okay? But I remember writing the first couple of drafts of that, and it was the scene was always the same scene. It was in the same place the entire time, but it always felt so bloody stagnant. And everything ground to a halt, right? So much so I remember we'd gotten to a point where we're kind of relatively happy to take a version of the script to storyboards, right? So Tom, the director, would kind of like take the script and he says, right, we'll do an animatic and do storyboards. And he likes to rewrite using storyboards. And he went and rewrote that scene with these little fairies. And there were warriors and all that sort of stuff. And it was a lot of chatting. There was a lot of movement and there was a lot of all this sort of stuff. But once they had it all put together, it still didn't work. It just didn't work. And we kind of had kicked the ball down the road for like quite a while and had come to a point where we said, we actually have to solve this now. We really have to solve this. So I remember there was a group meeting organized for like a Tuesday morning. And to have a meeting about it. And I remember the night before.
So you had like a lot of the rest of the film figured out except for this one crucial scene.
Oh yeah. Yeah, it was basically, the whole film was written at this stage. It was storyboarded and all this sort of stuff. And
where does this come in the story? Act one, start of act two?
Beginning of act two. So when the kids are kind of taken into the new world and mm-hmm. they have to be explained. And the night before I went to bed, I was like going, I just went, okay, concentrate on the problem. You have this fucking boring, inert scene that we just can't kick into life. How are we going to do this and make it feel fun or make it work? And I went to sleep with that problem and I woke up and I was in the shower the following morning and it came to me and I just went.
Isn't it funny? All the best ideas come in the shower.
Yep.
It's when you got your lad out. That's the key to everything.
I talked to my own little Richard.
Oh my god, we saw the pics, sign up for our Discord.
But that morning it was like someone saying, you stupid idiot, this film is so anchored in music and song and story and you're using warriors and all that sort of stuff.
It's not an I wish song, it's exposition.
Yeah, oh, it is this. Exactly. It's the I with song. And I just went, oh my God, we do it with song and music.
Before the Selkie sings her song to send us home, we should entertain her with a few of our own tunes. So lads, your choice. Who'll get us started?
Here, look, I'll sing.
And an old traditional Irish music score, like, you know, and we just dump all our exposition in there. And our kids, like the boy protagonist, it's kind of like basically he's a kid who's got all the exposition of all the olden times and he's forgotten it. And as he's listening to these lads trying to remember the song, he's the one with the missing pieces of the verse. And he's like going, oh yeah, I know all this. And he's like contributing to basically the telling of the rules of the world to the audience and himself, because he already kind of knows it because his mother has already told him in bedtime stories. It just clicked. Like I went in that day, wrote a version of that scene, put down the basic lyrics, and then Keela, I remember Cullen from Keela, fair play to him, he went and took what I had written down and put it to
Ran with it.
And he gave me a credit in that, like in the song, like, you know, for lyrics on that particular song.
But sure, do I have to redo the opening intro to say that you're also a member of ASCAP or something?
Actually, I think I am.
Oh, God.
I've never seen any...
I have a Tesco club card.
How did I manage that?
Long, long we prayed to hear the Selkie song, and now we pray again that her song will never end.
You! That's it!
Basically, music and song are a great way of delivering exposition.
Or, as James Cameron would say, action.
Action.
Deliver your exposition in the middle of action. And mm-hmm. I remember, I think this is on the Terminator audio commentary, where he says that a great way to hide all this exposition that Kyle Reese had to give.
I'm Reese, Sergeant Tetcom, BN38416, assigned to protect you. You've been targeted for termination.
It's an awful lot of like information to deliver. And think about it. If you had to have a sit-down scene between those two characters, they're on a bench or something, and he's saying to her, no, you're going to have a son in 10 years, whatever, he's going to get chased by another Terminator, but we won't talk about that right now. I just want to tell you about this guy that's coming.
Yeah,
you're going to fall pregnant. I don't know who the dad is. They never told me that bit. But
she's calling the cops saying there's a psycho here like opposite me.
But to bury it in the middle of action, so she's no choice but to believe him because she's getting chased by fucking Arnold Schwarzenegger and he's like shooting at them.
How could that man just get up after you
did? Not a man. Machine. Terminator. Cyber 9 Systems Model 101.
that's an excellent way to bury your exposition, to hide it.
A machine? Like a robot?
Not a robot. Cyborg. Cybernetic organism.
No.
Brilliant. You know, put your character, have it in a high intensity situation where it's like, fuck, what's going on?
Create some razzle dazzle around it. Make it a moment. Yeah. Make it matter.
Yeah. And that's why, you know, in a lot of musicals, they're, as you point out, even in Disney movies, they all have, like, going back to Snow White and Seven Dwarfs, there's Snow White is singing,
I'm dreaming of the one I love, divine me today.
You know, and she's, it's the I Wish song.
I remember years back reading about Minority Report and how they had to tell the audience what the premise of the movie was and how it all worked. And they were trading pages back and forth to different writers and what have you. I think John August covered it on his blog, johnaugust.com. You can go have a look at it there. I'm sure it might be still up. I haven't checked recently. But it came down to what we were saying about show, don't tell, where it became about the ball, the red ball, the murder ball, rolling along the table and him catching it.
When the precogs declare a victim and a killer, their name is embedded in the grain of wood. Since each piece is unique, the shape and grain is unique. The shape and grain is impossible to forge.
I'm sure you all understand the legalistic drawback to pre-crime methodology.
Here we go again.
Look, I'm not with the ACLU on this, Jeff. But let's not kid ourselves. We are arresting individuals who have broken no law.
But they will.
The commission of the crime itself is absolute metaphysics. The precogs see the future and they're never wrong.
But it's not the future if you stop it. Isn't that a fundamental paradox?
Yes, it is. You're talking about predetermination, which happens all the time. Why'd you catch that?
Because it was going to fall.
You're certain?
Yeah.
But it didn't fall.
You caught it.
The fact that you prevented it from happening doesn't change the fact that it was going to happen.
It's Tom Cruise explaining to Colin Farrell, the audience surrogate, look, I caught the ball. It didn't hit the floor, but I knew it was going to hit the floor. That's what we're doing. We are preempting an expected outcome based on everything we know. So it was a very succinct way to pitch that entire movie. And then in all the trailers, you see that the whole movie summed up by they catch the ball. That's what they're doing before the ball hits the floor.
Isn't that an excellent example of a little hooky bit of exposition?
Rather than in movies with the explaining a wormhole by taking two pieces of paper, folding them in half and putting a pencil through it. It's like it's still one sheet of paper, but we've just folded it.
Imagine for a minute that this piece of paper represents space-time and you want to get from point A here to point B there. Now, what's the shortest distance between two points?
A straight line.
Wrong. The shortest distance between two points is zero, and that's what the gateway does. It folds space so that point A and point B coexist in the same space and time. When the spacecraft passes through the gateway, space returns to normal. It's called a gravity drive.
I don't mind that, actually, but I love, because that image, the actual image of that red ball, I can visualize it right now, of it moving across that translucent countertop and Colin Farrell catching it. It's a compelling image. I'm just like, yeah, I got the whole concept right there.
Do you remember Rian Johnson in Looper had Bruce Willis explain time travel to Joseph Gordon-Levitt by saying,
so do you know what's going to happen? You done all this already as me?
I don't want to talk about time travel shit. Because if we start talking about it, then we're going to be here all day talking about it, making diagrams with straws. It doesn't matter.
When I hurt myself, it changes your body. So is what I do now change your memory?
It doesn't matter!
I'm not going to bother. It's just too confusing. Don't worry about it. This is the way it goes, but don't worry about the science. Forget it. I thought it was clever. It's a funny way to subvert all that stuff.
Yeah, just forget about it, forget about it. Enjoy the film. Another one that actually just popped into my head as you were talking earlier on, and I went, you know what? I love this little exposition scene because it's delightful. And it's from a Richard Donner film. It's The Goonies. The one in The Goonies where the gang all go into the attic and there's lightning and all that.
Yeah.
And they find a map.
Hey, Mike found a map.
Yeah.
Hey, look. That says 1632. Is that a year or something?
No, it's your top score on pole position.
Yes, it's a year, Chuck. Look, it's a map of our coastline.
What's all that Spanish junk right there?
Who knows? Mouth, you said you could translate. Translate, right here.
Yeah, translate it.
of that music, that lovely fucking music twinkling, the mystery, and all of them are leaning in. And it's like someone, it's you feel like you're with them, and this sense of, you know, they've gone into the forbidden room and they've found the true secret. And you're leaning in. The audience is leaning in this moment. And it's so enticing. It creates
it's the promise
tone
of the movie.
Yeah, it's a great. If you just showed me that exposition scene, I think I would. I feel I would want to watch that film just from that exposition scene. It's enough.
No, see, One-Eyed Willie stole treasure once. It was full of rubies and emeralds and diamonds. And then he loaded it all up onto a ship, and they sailed away into the sunset until the British king, see, he found out about it, and then he set up this whole armada to go out after him. And then the armada, it took him a couple weeks, but then they caught up with Willie, and then there was a whole big war between the armada and Willie's ship, the Inferno. And during the firefight, there was just guns bursting here and cannons bursting there. And then Willie fled, because he didn't want to stay around, because he knew he'd get killed if he stayed around. And then he got into this cave, and then the British, they blew up the walls all around him, and he got caved in, and he's been there ever since. Forever? Forever. And ever? Trapped. Wow.
You've teed me up, so now I'm going to have to do the obligatory thing and mention Superman, Dawn of Superman.
There we go. Okay.
But honest to God, I used this when I did a screenwriting talk. As great exposition, and it is Lois Lane interviewing Superman, and she's right. asking him the questions that set up his power set, what he can do, what he can't do, but it's all done in a very flirtatious, they're on a first date and she is like falling in love with him, and there's like playful banter where she asks him, what colour underwear am I wearing, and he
what
goes,
what colour, Kevin?
What colour underwear am I wearing?
These lovely little flourishes, but it's all exposition. It's telling you who Superman is, what he can do.
Oh, I'm sorry, I embarrassed you, didn't I?
Oh, no.
I did.
No, not at all, Miss Lane. It's just that this platter must be made of lead.
Yes, it is, so?
Oh, you see, I sort of have a problem seeing through lead.
Oh, that's interesting. Problems and first name. Do you have a first name?
What do you mean, like Ralph or something?
No, I mean like...
Pink.
Huh? Pink.
I don't know if I've ever said it before in the podcast, and I love that film so much.
Sorry, Miss Lane. I didn't mean to embarrass you.
Oh, you didn't embarrass me.
Do you know what other film I loved?
Go on.
Grabbers.
Tell me about the exposition dump in Grabbers.
Grabbers has got lots of them, because I'm basically setting up the premise of the movie and telling the audience what the characters have to do. So they learn about the creatures, or they're from water, they feed on blood, they're allergic to alcohol, all this kind of stuff. But there's one aspect, and I loved writing all that stuff because it was funny, because it was like the characters had to react to the preposterous plot that was unfolding. And it was like fun to write and fun to have my lead character pitch this to the gang as well as the audience, like, and it was just like really playful and fun to write. But there's one aspect to Grabbers that, oddly enough, Attack the Block did something very, very similar. There was no other films I could think of at the time that had basically a bigger alien following a smaller alien based on its scent. So in Grabbers, everywhere the little one was taken or went, the bigger one followed. So he was following the scent of her. And that was why it was showing up in certain places, and they put it together and they knew it was going to be at the pub because of the scent markings or whatever. But I didn't know a way that you could show scent. So it was just like explaining it. You can't show smell.
Yeah.
However, in Attack the Block, I remember being in the cinema, and Grabbers was in post at this point, and going, oh, fuck, that's a really fucking clever way to do it. Why didn't I think of that? But then also, it wouldn't have fit our story.
Yeah.
But it fit their one perfectly. So in Attack the Block, the bigger gorilla wolf motherfuckers, or whatever they're called, they're following the corpse of the one that they've killed.
Right.
And that was like a queen that was sent there, and the scent markings or whatever. But they go into Nick Frost's grow room where he's growing all the marijuana, and they turn on the blacklight. And when they turn on the blacklight, suddenly there is neon glowing stains all over them, which is the scent markings from the dead alien. And you can see that the scent is visually, it's all over them. But you wouldn't have seen that except for he turned on the blacklight.
Oh, okay.
And it was like, that they've just shown you what I explained to you, and showing you is better. So it becomes a bigger reveal in their movie. But it was just something that stuck with me. Yeah, always show it if you can.
You've teed me up to talk about Wolfwalkers. I've never brought up Wolfwalkers before.
Gorilla Wolfwalkers, motherfuckers.
But what you're saying actually, you know, dovetails kind of very neatly into my experience in Wolfwalkers. And in it, we have this whole concept of Wolfwalkers. Like, you know, they're not werewolves. You know, it's the idea is when you're awake, you're a human person. But when you go to sleep, you become a wolf. That's kind of it, right?
So it's a lovely film. I'm glad I finally saw it.
I still don't believe you. I still don't believe it. But in that, right, the exposition only happens when Robin, the little girl protagonist who's out there, whose job is to hunt the wolves, becomes a wolfwalker. And she actually is like, she wakes up as one of those things. And it's like, what the fuck is happening to me? And she's in the worst possible situation for that to happen to her in the room of her dad, who was there and hired to kill exactly, you know, her in that moment, in that as a wolf. So she has to flee, and she flees out into the woods, and she goes to the one place where she can. And she's also freaked out because you're talking about scent. That was one of the ideas I had, where, you know, that we went into wolf vision in Wolfwalkers. And I remember thinking, it was like, oh shit, wouldn't it be so cool that she can see, as like all canines do, they see like time is measured through scent. You know, they see primarily true scent, you know, and she could see like deers moving around, but it's all freaking her out and all that sort of stuff. And she has to get to that little wild girl out in the woods to explain to her, or some sort of refuge. And the little wild girl is really threatening and a bit kind of playful and mean and nasty, but they have this beautiful scene together. It's all explained. She explains the whole lot about like what you are, how it works, all that sort of stuff. And isn't it absolutely great? And now we're buddies, you know? And it's done in a really beautiful...
And aren't I great? Art. I want a BAFTA for writing this. Great, I did, you know, great exposition in, really in this film. Kind of, it's so
this
good.
This is like not crediting me. This is crediting all the amazing artists and the beautiful piece of music that's used to accompany it. But it just, it feels like a trailer moment. That whole sequence is a trailer moment. Like, you know, so that's kind of how it works.
Well, just like with Minority Report, great exposition can be trailer moments.
Yeah, it's good to reiterate. I think it's important.
There's a few exposition scenes that are student-teacher moments where suddenly the movie stops and you'll have Doc Brown explaining to Marty with a chalkboard, 1985 A, 1985 B, and he'll draw the line that's parallel and intersecting on a different timeline, and it's done for the audience, but it's also done for Marty.
Imagine that this line represents time. Here's the present, 1985, the future... and the past. Prior to this point in time, somewhere in the past, the timeline skewed into this tangent, creating an alternate 1985. Alternate to you, me, and Einstein, but reality for everyone else.
Or Raiders of the Lost Ark, you know, where I think we spoke about it. I think it might have even been like the second episode we did and the second probably scene we picked. The exposition, no, it wouldn't have been.
It is. It was Harrison Ford, best Harrison Ford scene. I think I did that one.
Yeah, the exposition. Yeah. So go way back to episode 2.
Yeah.
And you'll hear me being very timid on the microphone. And like, yeah, well, okay.
That's being polite to each other and not talking about dick pics.
Ah, oh, God, happy days. We were all so new to what was ahead of us. But yeah, so I remember Linda Seeger. I went to a screenwriting course and Linda Seeger was talking about why that scene worked. And it worked because Spielberg had given us 15 minutes of pure action. We were dropped right in to the action. And because he had delivered spectacularly with that opening sequence, that then when he slowed down and said, no, this is what the story is going to be about. This is the adventure. This is the scene where Ethan Hunt gets your mission, should you choose to accept it. Or Bond is told, you know, go and sleep with this woman and sleep with that woman and sleep with this woman and then come back with the briefcase.
Go to the clinic.
I'll do it for Her Majesty.
I'm looking for Dr. Goodhead.
You just found her.
A woman.
Two that I love.
Okay.
I just chose The Thing last episode with Ambiguous Ending. But it's the moment, the 28,000 hours moment, when the doctor is sitting at the computer terminal and he's watching the little graphic of the thing cell subsuming the other cell and then the next one, and this being an apocalyptic event and that it can take over the whole world in 28,000 hours. And it is so spooky. And I just love that sequence. But there's one to a film that I think breaks the fourth wall.
Okay.
And I don't love it because it breaks the fourth wall. But I wonder what your take on it would be. And it's from my beloved Jurassic Park. Okay. And it's the Mr. DNA, Dino DNA guy.
What? What? Oh, Mr. DNA, where did you come from?
From your blood. Just one drop of your blood contains billions of strands of DNA, the building blocks of life. A DNA strand, like me, is a blueprint for building a living thing. And sometimes animals that went extinct millions of years ago, like dinosaurs, left their blueprints behind for us to find. We just had to know where to look.
It's an animation when they go into the theme park and they're all sitting there in the little cinema seats, and he's, you know, Richard Attenborough is doing the pinprick and he's talking to himself, and then up comes the little DNA graphic and he is like,
this fossilized tree sap, which we call amber, waited for millions of years with the mosquito inside until Jurassic Park scientists came along.
It takes over the film, and it's essentially just for us, so we are watching the Dino DNA animation. Mm-hmm. And I always found that stylistically an odd choice. It just felt like we thought, well, fuck it, we don't need to have the characters watching this. Let's just put it straight on the screen and have the audience watching it like it's an infomercial in the middle of the film.
It'd take 2 years to look at the entire DNA strand.
I honestly think it falls into the category, as you were describing earlier on, of like the Raiders of the Lost Ark, where he's having the school lecture, you know, talking about the stuff, or James Bond or Minority Report. Simply because we've already had them see a brontosaurus in the wild. We've already had that kind of exhilarating opening attack with the velociraptor being caged. It's almost, I think it's totally fine because it's a moment of, right, okay, everyone sit in your seats, hold on, calm down a second, because it's going to get very, very exciting after this. And I think in films where the excitement gets fucking heightened, 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 it's okay to actually just get your characters who are going to do a lot of running in the film to actually sit down and be chilled for a few minutes.
Imagine it this way. Imagine if in the middle of the Raiders of the Lost Ark scene, Harrison Ford then turns to the camera, looks at us, and then says, this is where I'm going to go, and this is what I'm after, and these guys are here for this. And then he slips back into character. It's this breaking the fourth wall thing that I always found brazen, but it works. I never questioned it as a kid, but it's only, you know, on rewatches of the film where I would go like, huh, he really just thought, fuck it, let's just break the film and have it speak directly to the audience so that they know everything they need to know about the film.
Well, what I like about that moment is how Sam Neill's character goes, fuck this. And he's like, stop. And he's pushing against the guardrails that are keeping him, you know,
seasoned. I don't want no exposition in my fucking story.
Yeah. He's like, shut up. And he just pushes and he just breaks out. It breaks off the right. And I think that's also speaking to what's actually happening in that story. Is like, you know, no matter how much you want to curate this, it's impossible because you can't even keep the humans, you know, on track. You can't even, the first go around, you can't keep the humans on track as much as you wanted to. So, but I think it works. I think it's, for in that specific instance, it works. Because then that brings up an awful lot of, you know, a really, really lazy and it's not lazy. It's kind of shorthand and it works in an awful lot of context. Newsreel or news footage, you know.
RoboCop,
Children
Crimson
of Men.
Tide. Children, you know, men, yeah.
And, you know, in the right circumstance, when it feels organic and natural. And
the Children of Men one, though, is what I'm talking about, where we never leave the movie. We're just catching glimpses of it. It's on the coffee shop television. But that's so slight. It's just enough where you
just
feel like
enough.
They're not lecturing me.
That's the key.
Do you know my granny always used to say?
What's she always?
All you need is enough.
All you need is enough. That's actually very wise. Do you know one of the things that I've leaned into a lot recently? It's come into my lexicon.
BAFTA.
No. Trust ellipses. Right? And ellipses is for those...
The spaces between...
Just dot, dot, dot.
Thoughts.
Yeah. The spots. Yeah. The absence of something, right? Basically, you know, trust that the audience will be able to fill in the gaps. That's what an ellipsis is. You know, it's a gap. And I think give them enough and make sure you give them enough ellipses for them to fill in the gaps. Because if you fill in if you fill it in for them, it's boring. You just like any kind of really good natural storyteller, they'll give you just enough information to tell you a great yarn. Just enough, not too
much. What's funny is that Aristotle, who coined expositions in his Poetics work. Okay. I should have said this way up front at the top, but I'll say it now. So exposition goes back to Aristotle's Poetics,
you
know, his work on writing. And he described exposition as it's essential background information that an audience needs to know in order to understand the plot and the characters. And it's just enough. You don't need any more than that. If you give them too much, it becomes leaden. If you don't give them enough, they become detached and bored.
Yeah. So, yeah. There you go. Just
my
enough.
Granny was right. Just like Aristotle.
Yeah.
All you need is enough.
Too much and everyone just checks out. Yeah, I agree 100%.
You can have fun with it as well, though. Like in The Dark Knight, where the Joker kept inventing his backstory. And I just kept changing the context of the character.
Do you want to know how I got these scars? I tried to swallow a whole cooked chicken in one bite. All of it. Don't do it.
That's like, you know, kind of exposition.
Yeah.
Like, who is he?
But exactly. And do we need to know? Do we absolutely need to
know?
They did it in Saving Private Ryan as well, where it was like the history of Tom Hanks's character. It was like, you know, Captain Tom Hanks, you know, what he did before he was in the war, and he never told anyone. And it was kind of this running thing that kind of kept going, you know, throughout the story until eventually he did reveal it.
Funnily enough, this is similar to ambiguous endings, where it's like, don't tell us too much. Don't explain everything. My other beloved film, Tremors, never explains what the monsters are. You never get an explanation for, are they aliens? Are they dinosaurs? Are they mutations? Are they concocted or are they just undiscovered creatures? And the film is better for that because it doesn't impact the story.
Absolutely. I think maybe what's happened, and it's kind of like what we're talking about with in the contemporary era of the last 20 years, there's this, and maybe it's franchise, maybe that's the reason, where there's a sense that you have to lay the groundwork for other films that are coming out there and all that sort of stuff. You dump a lot of information, get it in there, make sure everyone knows exactly what's happening so that they can connect the threads to some other film that's going to be happening in 5 years' time or something like that. I don't know. But for the purposes of telling a story, you need to just give them enough. Your granny, Kevin's granny, is going to go into the screenwriting lecture books. All you need is enough.
Yeah, Granny Lee Han. She was a Christian fundamentalist, but she was lovely.
Fair play to her, you know?
She went to mass every single day. Every day. Did you believe it?
And she actually protested Jurassic Park because there's no way any of that is real.
No, she actually did the sit-down protests in London.
About Jurassic Park?
Yeah, about Jurassic Park, yeah. She was 70 years of age. She said, fucking hell, the exposition is outrageous.
The world is 5,000 years old. There's no way.
Dinosaurs are a myth. Are you telling me that Jesus was around at the time of the dinosaurs? I don't believe it. He was a good Christian white man and he had the face of a fucking angel.
If they can resurrect dinosaurs, why can't they resurrect Jesus? Why can't we have a film about the resurrection of Jesus? That's all I'm saying.
He is the one.
Your beloved film. Let's talk about one of your beloved films, Highlander.
Ho ho! There's a lot of exposition going on there, but by God, isn't it fun when Sean Connery shows up? Oh! It's one of my favourite bits. Because we've got brilliant background music, scoring. I probably Michael Kamen scores at the time. That's probably Michael Kamen. And it's a great
miss him so
score.
Much.
Yeah.
Every film was improved when he was on board.
Yeah. And Russell Mulcahy. him having his roots in music videos.
Australia.
Yeah, in Australia. He knew how to cut things together at a pace, at a clip, and keep it moving along with the score. So it was musical. It was musical. And just the mysticism and the mystery and the panache that Sean Connery's character, the Spaniard who was also an Egyptian. I love that film. It's great fun.
From the dawn of time we came, moving silently down through the centuries, living many secret lives, struggling to reach the time of the gathering, when the few who remain will battle to the last. No one has ever known we were among you. Until now.
Here we are!
Great exposition. Doesn't make a lick of sense, but it's great crack. And it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if it doesn't make sense. It just has to be.
Executives?
Doesn't matter.
That's a writer talking. It doesn't matter.
Yeah. As long as it feels like it works, that's the main thing.
Yeah. Definitely. No, I agree with all that.
I live to regret that soundbite, won't I? As long as it feels like it works.
It doesn't matter if it doesn't mix. It doesn't matter.
Do you know what's a film that I think is killed by exposition? And I've mentioned it to you in the past. Look, we're coming up on nearly 300 episodes at this stage across all the different variations of the podcast.
Yeah.
So we will start repeating ourselves.
It doesn't matter.
But in Inception, that film is wall to wall.
Yeah.
Exposition. And Elliot Page's character is basically the audience surrogate of, give me all you got, lads. Tell me everything. I don't have a fucking clue about anything. So hang on, you've got to sit in a chair and fall backwards to wake up. But if you go deeper into a dream, everything slows down more. And I feel that character was the weak spot in the film because they're just a receptacle for exposition. And the scenes, one of the best scenes, you know, where the world is folding over and stuff. And that's all, like, that was jaw-dropping in the cinema. But I do wish that the character had more to do where the superpower that they have of making mazes came into effect. I didn't need the snow-cap, you know, mountainside chase with Tom Hardy and stuff. Give me some crazy labyrinth mazes and stuff.
You brought something up there, right?
Get MC Escher on my ass.
I can arrange that for you. I know a guy. He does stuff.
His name is Richard, is it?
Richard, yes, Richard. Also, keen photographer. That film is, you're right, probably 75% exposition, right? It somehow still works.
And 85% montage.
Yes. But it's somehow, as an experience, it still works. That whole film still works. Because I think the concept, that hook of that idea is relatable. I kind of get it. Versus his later film, Tenet. I still don't know what Tenet is. I still haven't a clue. I still don't get the concept. And that hook doesn't work. And all of the exposition, that whole film just did not work for me. Because the core expositional hook didn't grab me, didn't click, didn't make sense. And as a result, the whole film kind of fumbles and it kind of crumbles underneath that weak structure.
The recent Dune 2, I thought Denis Villeneuve handled exposition really well, where
screenwriters, he was not, give them credit.
John Spates.
And Eric Roth.
Isn't that terrible?
Yeah.
But you know what? I just don't value writers. I just think that they've got no riz. So fuck them. Yeah, he didn't over-explain anything in that film. He just dropped me in it and trusted me. And I think he made that film specifically for me. He trusted me to be able to get it, where it was like, they've jumped several weeks into the future. And now he is in this position in his evolution as a character. And now he's able to do this. And this is what climbing onto a worm means and all that kind of stuff. And I loved it. I loved that nobody was sitting me down and saying, now remember, but what you don't realize, and you gotta, and just be careful, because there was none of that. It was all, go with it. You're smart enough. You're big and ugly enough to be able to handle it. And he was right. I was able to handle it. I loved it.
Yeah. And in the first film, I liked how they did in the first film. They did it like in a very classical, oh my God, like this, it's title cards on the screen. This is this year. This is this time. Here's Paul Atreides, and he's looking at an encyclopedia hologram about Arrakis and how Arrakis works. it works. It's an information dump, but it works because it is alluring and beautiful and sensual. And the score, there's a tone and a mystery and a vibe that really is there. And I want to go a step further, right?
You're very excited looking. Go
on. But it's because it's just come into my head, right? But not the first time it's come up. My favorite scene in David Lynch's 1984 Dune is the very, very first scene, which is the information dump with Virginia Madsen's face.
Yeah, but that's because her face is a special effect.
But she's beautiful looking, but there is a mystery in her delivery, right? There is something about the way she's presenting the table of this galaxy.
A beginning is a very delicate time. Know then that it is the year 10,191. The known universe is ruled by the Padishah Emperor Shaddam IV, my father.
That's very intoxicating and alluring. And I'm like going, yes, Virginia Madsen, I will go with you anywhere. Please take me with you into this planet. And we never see her again, really.
Also known as Dune.
Maybe that's the way to do it. Make exposition thrilling, whether that is a flirtatious scene like the date in Superman or a frustrating date scene like at the start of Social Network. Or maybe it's hidden in action where they're getting shot at and they're in a speeding car. Or maybe it is doom closing in like in The Thing or like in the JFK scene with Donald Sutherland.
Everything I'm going to tell you is classified top secret.
But he just comes in and just dumps all this exposition on Kevin Costner and tells him, boy, you don't have the half of it. Wait until I tell you.
When the president was killed, Oswald was charged at 7 p.m. Dallas time with Tippett's murder. That's 2 o'clock in the afternoon of the next day, New Zealand time. But already, their papers had the entire history of this unknown 24-year-old man, Oswald. Studio picture, detailed biographical data, Russian information, and were pretty sure of the fact that he killed the president alone, although it took them 4 more hours before they even charged him with that crime in Dallas. Felt to me as if, well, a cover story was being put out, like we would in a black op.
Or song, like you.
Yeah.
You're making it a moment.
Another one, just to add to the collection here.
A trailer moment.
Oliver Stone's Wall Street from 1987. And in that, we open on Wall Street in this pit of loud voices shouting down phones, shouting at each other, like looking
buy,
at screens.
Sell, sell.
But we zero in on Charlie Sheen. And it doesn't, on your first introduction to it, it's just a massive noise of just, it's just chaos, right? But as that early scene, plays out, you get the sense that Charlie Sheen is on his back foot. He's desperately failing. He's just a pup with all these other pups with older, toothless wolves, failed wolves around him. And he desperately, desperately wants to get in with the alpha pack, the vicious, lean, slick Gordon Gekko. And they're all talking about, the price of commodities and all this sort of stuff. It doesn't make any fucking sense, but you get the feeling that he's fucked. He's losing money hand over fist. He's really, really screwed. And for him to move forward in the world, there is a place, there's a den that he wants to get to. You don't really need to know any of the mechanics of the world. You just know who he is, where he is in that world, and where he wants to go to. And it's delivered very, very subtly. It works.
But you've reminded me of The Big Short, the Adam McKay film, where all the exposition in that was delivered by movie stars, where Adam McKay was like, look, this is going to be really complicated for people to have to understand. So let's get Margaret Robbie in a bubble-filled bath and telling us how the subprime mortgages worked in the US.
Here's Margot Robbie in a bubble bath to explain.
Fuck off.
That's fun.
Yeah.
Make it a moment.
Make it a moment, yeah. And seeing exposition is happening all the time. And if you can do it subtly, you can pepper it throughout the entire film. You can just pepper it as long as it's not overbearing and it's not dragging down your story or stalling your story. That's the key to it.
Or if you're really, really good, you can make it, you can just deliver that punch in one go. And it's like, there you go. That's all you need to know. Now we're off. I've only got one more to mention, and that's my pick.
I don't have a specific favorite pick, right?
Do you know what? The main point of our podcast is to have a framework to talk about things that we love. So it doesn't matter what you pick, really, ultimately.
It doesn't matter.
Yeah. But I do have a final thing that I want to say. Having worked in the fantasy genre, and I think anyone like you yourself, anything that involves, like in a horror genre, anything involves any sort of fantastical element, you have no choice but to deal with exposition because you have to teach your audience the rules of the world. The more fantastical the bloody world is, the more you have to teach your audience. You can't teach them a lot because you can't make it a lecture. You have to make sure that the stuff you're depositing on them is simple, it's clear, it's exciting, and it's hooky, okay? Now, after saying that, I'm not going to go to a specific film where I think, oh, this is brilliant exposition. I'm going to do counter. I think the best exposition is the exposition that you don't notice is there, you know, that it's done incredibly subtly and you just feel it. You just absorb it through your pores and the film just moves along. And I'm going to highlight a film. And the film I'm going to highlight is...
stop it. Come on.
And the film, I'm picking this because I had a whole bunch of films that I was going to mention. Every film has got exposition. And the one I actually think... Actually
Jesus Christ. Are you doing this deliberately? Stop.
No. Okay. How they deal with exposition in Die Hard is really effective, right? Because...
There isn't really any exposition, is there?
But this is the thing. It's all incredibly subtly dealt out, you know? I love that it's just he's flying to LA to spend holiday with his wife. You go, oh, they're in trouble. Holly isn't, she's working under her maiden name. You know, all this stuff, there's little subtleties, subtle stuff that's there that doesn't...
Then there's an argument.
There's an argument.
And they spit all the stuff. You didn't want to do this. Oh, we're going to have this conversation again. That's beautifully done. That's beautifully done.
Where are you staying? Things happened so fast, I didn't get a chance to ask you on the phone.
Cappy Roberts retired out here.
Oh, yeah?
Tell me I could bunk in with him.
Cappy retired, huh? Where does he live?
Ramona.
Pomona.
Huh?
Pomona.
Pomona.
Yeah. God, you'll be in the car half the time. Why don't we make it easy? I have a spare bedroom. I mean, it's not huge or anything, but kids would love to have you at the house.
They would, huh?
I would, too.
I guess you didn't miss my name, though, huh? Except maybe when you're signing checks. Since when did you start using Ms. Gennaro?
It's a Japanese company. They figure a married woman's got...
You are a married woman, Holly. You're married to me.
Are we going
to
have this conversation again? We did this in July.
We never finished this conversation in July.
I had an opportunity. I had to take it.
Right. No matter what the consequences, no matter what it did to our marriage, you had to take this opportunity.
It didn't do anything to our marriage except maybe change your idea of what our marriage should be.
I don't think you have a clue as to what my idea of our marriage should be.
I know exactly what your idea of our marriage should be.
Ms. Gennaro,
That's exposition. You're dealing... It's ellipsis. It's giving us just enough information to be able to fill in the blanks of the rest of this world, right? And then we do have the robbers just come in. But their exposition is kind of drip-fed along.
I watched it again recently at Christmas time, and the thing that I noticed this last time watching it, and it sort of speaks to your point, and I noticed with Die Hard that every character in that film only enters the story when they impact the story.
Hey, there
so,
you go.
There's no setup with Hans Gruber. He just arrives 20 minutes in. The reporter guy, he's like 55 minutes in.
Yeah.
Powell, he comes in about 35 minutes in. They only enter the story when it matters. We enjoy them because they're changing the dynamic of the story.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I suppose with Die Hard, exposition is sort of just peppered right throughout it.
It's good storytelling. I want to strip away the idea of it's good screenwriting. It's just good storytelling. It's good storytelling. That's all we're talking about here.
Good job.
I wish that people would talk more about storytelling and sort of screenwriting, because screenwriting, it sort of boils it down into technical writing, and you can get tied up in the weeds with that stuff.
In my walk earlier on this morning, I was thinking about this. I was brought back to, you know, yeah, I love movies and all that sort of stuff. But when I grew up around several great storytellers, like oral story, not people who said, sit down, children, I tell you. Just local people. Like I've an uncle-in-law who just had a cadence and a way of just telling a story, which just as soon as he started speaking, he caught your attention. And he knew how to lure you into the story and get you going, get you excited.
I've loads of family like that.
Yeah. So we're born into a culture of really good storytellers.
We're not a good example of that though, are we?
And I'm going to highlight a film, which I'll highlight now in a second. No. That's my pick. I'm picking Die Hard.
Right.
That's what I'm going
and
to pick.
And I'm going to fly in the face of everything that we've been saying about making stuff a moment, you know, adding in all these big spectacle things to distract you from the exposition or to throw in a song or to have somebody being really alluring and sexy or any of that stuff. One of my favorite exposition scenes is just two people on a bench and one person proposing something to another, which flips their worldview entirely upside down. And it's just dialogue, beautifully written, punchy writing. It's the elevator pitch.
Can I guess?
Go on.
Is it Forrest Gump?
No. Life's like a box of chocolates.
That's what I was thinking.
Good kid.
What is it?
It's from Men in Black.
Here come the MIBs.
And it's Tommy Lee Jones is sitting on a park bench with Will Smith and he tells him,
all right, kid, here's the deal. At any given time, there are around 1,500 aliens on the planet. Most of them right here in Manhattan. And most of them are decent enough. They're just trying to make a living.
Cab drivers.
Well, not as many as you'd think. Humans, for the most part, don't have a clue. They don't want one or need one either. They're happy. They think they have a good bead on things.
Well, why the big secret? People are smart. They can handle it.
A person is smart. People are dumb, panicky, dangerous animals, and you know it. 1,500 years ago, everybody knew the Earth was the center of the universe. 500 years ago, everybody knew the Earth was flat, and 15 minutes ago, you knew that people were alone on this planet.
Imagine what you'll know tomorrow.
It's posing a question, big philosophical question, and it's putting a spin on the world. And it's the premise of the movie, which is that aliens have always existed here, and that there's a police force which is keeping everybody in the dark, and you can be part of that.
What's the catch?
The catch is you will sever every human contact. Nobody will ever know you exist anywhere. Ever. I'll give you the sunrise to think it over.
Hey, is it worth it?
Oh, yeah, it's worth it. If you're strong enough.
And he leaves him with that. And then you have Will Smith sitting on the bench. I think it's Ed Solomon wrote that script. There's no bells or whistles. There's no fireworks to it. It's simple blocking, beautifully pitched dialogue. And then it just ends on Will Smith sitting on the bench and cross cuts over the rest of the day as he's just staying in that seat, thinking about it and thinking about it and thinking about it as the sun goes down before he makes his decision. No histrionics. It's just great writing. Like, that would work on the page as well as it does on
but
screen.
But you know what's cool about that? That kind
trailer
of falls
moment.
In. Yeah. And it also falls into what we were talking about earlier on, is because about the bombast, the rest of the film being bombast and excitement. And there's this quiet moment in the real world. Ground is very,
slows
very
everything
stayed,
down.
Very, but that's it. As you said, it's that trailer moment. It's that exciting conundrum, that hook, that idea of, oh shit, what if, like, you're posing it to the audience.
You could tear out those two pages, I'd say that's all it is, of that script, and give it to anybody and say, this is my movie. And they'd be like, sold, just on the writing of that and the potential of what that movie could be, the premise that is pitched to Will Smith. Again, it's the writer pitching the story to the main character and to the audience. So that's my pick.
Very good. Very, very, very good. Woo! I've said this about this podcast every single episode. But I do think this strengthens my own writing, because it makes me reflect on what the fuck each kind of element is and how I should be thinking about it and how every aspect of it is important. And by golly, I have learned something in this episode just from this conversation, which is good.
You're welcome. You're absolutely welcome.
That we've got a corner just for Dick's Picks. And it's in our Discord, our patron exclusive Discord, where we also have many, many other episodes, mini bit episodes, which are out at least, you know, every couple of weeks. So
mini bits.
Nearly as many main shows, if not more.
Yeah. And do you know what, Will?
What?
We got a little voice note. He's a patron of ours on Apple. So he subscribes to us over there.
Yes.
And it's your topic for next week. And he is a very good friend of yours. So I'm going to play it for you.
Yes.
No.
Hello, Kevin and Will. Paul Young here from Cartoon Saloon. Producer and director in there of Cartoon Saloon Things. Talking to you from a very sunny and chirpy Kilkenny. I had an idea for one of your podcasts to do a show about opening titles and the best opening titles, or discussion on opening titles. I think it's a very interesting topic because they really set the table for movies in very interesting ways. Yeah, so I'd love to hear you guys talk about that.
There you go.
That is Paul Young. Yes, he's a great buddy of mine, a collaborator of many, many years. Paul is, as I call him, Paul Hollywood, not from the Bake Off, but he's Paul Hollywood in my eyes. Paul, the multi-Oscar nominated producer and now director, an all-around wonderful human being. And I'm so delighted to kind of get this topic from him. And I can't wait to get into it because it's kind of exciting.
Credit sequences, opening titles, I love them. I genuinely love them, and I miss them an awful lot in films, because we've gotten to a point where films just begin, a big massive fucking font title, bang, and the movie starts. And I do miss when they'd actually like lay out the carpet for you and go, here we go.
Hey, isn't that a great way for our patrons to give us suggestions? Actually, give us a voice note with their pick.
Yeah, or you can just email us, and you can do that by going to bestbitspodcast.com/contact. Tell us what you'd like us to do. There you go. That was fun. Thanks for listening. Enjoy the little clip to our mini bits that will come at the end of this. And until next time, Will. Bye, sis.
Bye.
The Best Bits podcast is produced by Will and Kevin. All audio clips and music heard in this episode is the intellectual property of the respective copyright holders, and no infringement is intended.
If you enjoyed this episode, please consider becoming a Patreon member, where you'll receive bonus shows where we talk about recent releases and what we're up to.
And you'll receive access to our Discord chat room, where we hang out with our listeners.
Search the Best Bits podcast on Patreon or click on the link in the show notes.
It doesn't matter.
And here is a clip from the lad's latest Mini Bits bonus show. The full episode, plus 100 more, are available on their Patreon. Mini Bits.
Well, the Best Bits boys are at it again. With the jokes and the jabs, driving me insane. Wish I had a shotgun, I'd blow my own brain. Listen to these bastards laughing and complain. Well, the Best Bits boys keep on talking shit. Once you get a job, the other just quit.
Play dumb and stupid.
Yeah, Best Bits boys, the rascals on the mic. Once a guinea bitch, the other take a shot. The Best Bits boys are at it again. Still enjoy the pain.
Okay. Kevin, what's going down?
What's going on? Not much. What about you?
Oh, you know, this is my last time recording in this office.
Ever.
Not ever.
This is the last episode.
Not ever.
Anyway, it's been great fun, everybody. Thank you.
This is the last time I'm recording an episode from this office, because we're on the move.
Ken Four.
We're on the move, Kevin.
We're on the move.
And
caravan's loaded up.
Yeah, we're becoming nomads. That's the plan. Becoming nomadic people.
Traveling all around the country in your horse and cart.
Yeah.
Look out for Will.
Do you ever remember...
Bring along your DVDs, he'll sign them for you.
You were probably too old to remember Wanderley Wagon.
Don't you mean too young?
You're probably too young to remember...
you just looked at me in the camera and thought, yeah, it's got to be old. It can't be young.
Yeah. You went too young. But Wanderlei Wagon was a children's preschool show that was on RTE for your time, because it was almost before my time. And there was a lovely theme tune to that. So if you want to insert that theme tune right there, be a nice little musical.
I love how you always tee me up for more editing. You said it on the last episode as well. The thing about Roy Keane was like, if you find the thing there with Roy Keane, so cut that in. And I thought, yeah. God, willie me, fuck. I'm just trying to get the episode done. You're not good looking.
But yes, you'll find the time to find 17 different various fart noises.
and I record them myself.
To the bathroom. Oh, can I tell you about something wonderful that did happen in my daily life in Donegal here? Donegal. We had the thing called the Legony Sheep Race.
Tell us about the Legony Sheep Race.
Ah, so Legony is a little community townland outside of Donegal town. It is up in the Bluestack Mountains, kind of bordering Tyrone, the north of Ireland. And it's a wonderful community. It's kind of like the heartland community where my wife, Karen, comes from, and all her family are up there. And we're actually moving up to that townland. And we...
So watch out.
We had a... It was... The original Legony Sheep Race happened in 2008. It's a fundraiser for the hall. And for every year they donate, every time they do it, they donate the excess funds to various charities and stuff like that.
Like the Legony Bingo Hall. That charity,
yeah,
and stuff.
Yeah, it's the Legony Bingo Hall, the Legony Drinking Society, the Legony Knitting Club, the
Legony Beer Garden.
The defunct Legony Film Club, which I set up and ran for one season. Maybe I'll do it again.
I don't know. Held in a shed with a corrugated roof, if I can remember correctly.
Kind of,
which is great. Yeah, acoustics for watching films.
Bad idea. Bad idea. I think I could revive it now, though. And
you sent me a video of the Legony sheep racing thing from about 10 years ago, where Karen's dad was one of the ushers.
That's right, yeah.
He was
showing
the sheep where to sit. Yeah. And
hey, over here!
It looked mental. So what? Do people put bets on? They race the sheep?
And I'm one of the bookies in the tents, right? I'm certified and all that sort of shit. And the odds are better than if you go to bet on a regular horse race, because you're guaranteed a minimum 3-1 payout if you win. Guarantee. It's like...
How does that work?
How it works is, I'm giving you inside baseball, it's completely random. There's no such
illegal
thing as... No, it's not. That's not illegal. It's all for charity. So what it
is prohibited.
So how it works is, right, we sell the sheep beforehand. People sponsor the sheep. Like I sponsored a couple of sheep so I could name them, and I should have named one the best bits. That's what I should have done.
What did you name it instead, Kevin?
Oh, I got Luke. Luke named it. He was big into The Simpsons. So instead of Santa's Little Helper, he named it Shepherd's Little Helper. So that's where.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Lame.
People bet on the sheep according to the name. So the favorite name was the one that got the most bets, you know?
See, if I was there, I would have named the sheep the funniest names for the guys to be shouting out. Where it'd be like...
Yeah. Lady Baba was one of my favorite ones.
Mad Granny is coming up the back. Here comes Mad Granny.
Yeah. It was great crack. So how the odds work out is basically we tally the amount of bets that are put on a particular sheep. Let's say if there's Mad Granny gets, so we know you're able to figure out 25 bets. As soon as the sheep race starts, we correlate all the bets, the amount of bets each sheep gets. Whichever sheep wins, X20 has to spray it out, so we're going to give them 40% of the winnings.
Do you know what? I'm following all of this and it's all making complete sense to me, and I know exactly what you're on about, and I guess we can move on from there. But it was a good day.
All I'm saying is, right, it's just an anchor for today. It really is a big family fun day to show the kind
of... And do you whip the sheep?
No, we don't whip the sheep. You don't whip the sheep.
What, you shoot firecrackers at them? You don't. That's awful.
You get nice, young, virile...
Children
charming.
To chase the sheep.
That's kind of it, yes. They chase the sheep around, and people were online complaining, says, oh my God, the poor sheep, this is a disgrace.
You saw my message.
Sheep are given the juiciest hay. It's about a 30-second gallop, you know, and they're given the juiciest hay afterwards, and they're left out in a lovely fresh field full of grass, and they're happy out.
Was anybody like slipping in a bit of sherbet into the hay to sort of like spice up the sheep?
Well,
fired up?
No, but I want to give you
Put a bit of Coca-Cola on that here.
Everyone left smiling, right? Because children were free. It's like children don't bet, and children are free. We had tourists come up because they were like, Donegal gets a lot of tourists.
From Roscommon.
Some of them. Roscommon. but to give you an example, some American tourists got a bus out to the hall. They thought there was no such thing as contactless, no card machine out there. It's all cash. They had no cash. So they were let in for free. And they were given, each of the kids given €5 each.
So the Americans got the charity.
So they get, well, that's the spirit of the people and the community up in Leggeting Hall. It's like, no, you've no money. Come on in. It's okay. Here's some money. Go on, take the hall. Take it. You know, take a sheep. They left with.
That's nice to feel part of a community like that. It's usually down in Cork, it's like you might get together and burn out a car and stuff like that. But beyond that, it's not really much. You know, that brings the community together.
It's lovely. It's really lovely. We'll share a link to some videos from highlights from the day.
The video I saw, I was stunned. I couldn't believe that she raised 200 sheep at once.
Mental. At the children.
Alongside the cliffs as well. Yeah. I couldn't believe it. It's unreal. Anyway, talk about some films, Will?
Yeah. I would love to talk about Alien Romulus because I just watched it last night.
Many bits.